So yeah.
I think you're gonna do great.
This
though.
Is,
I think you're
I
gonna do
know, but
great.
this is my first, you know, this is my first podcast interview. I'm used to creating the platform for other people,
which is weird. How come nobody has like hijacked you?
Because I've been saying no, you know, and this is my year of yes, you know. I read Shonda Rhimes, so lucky you, yes, for being persistent. Well done for being persistent. But
thank you.
I've been saying no to people for 2 years, so
what?
So lucky you,
lucky me. All right, let me just get right into it.
Okay.
Welcome back, everyone, to the podcast. This is your girl, Mo, and today we are continuing on our series with entrepreneurs. And today I have the founder of African Business Stories, which is a social enterprise focused on inspiring and multiplying success in Africa. She is, get this, guys, a dual qualified lawyer and business strategy expert with over 20 years of experience spanning multiple sectors and jurisdictions. She's a trusted business leader sought after to facilitate effective stakeholder engagement and drive trade and investment into Africa. She was head legal and corporate affairs at the EAN Aviation, where she played a leading role in establishing the first private jet terminal and aircraft maintenance facility in Nigeria. Throughout her career, she has held various impactful leadership roles, from global law firm DLA Piper LLP to the leading U.S. African Business Association Corporate Council on Africa. She's passionate about promoting female entrepreneurship. She is the host of the podcast Africa Business Stories, where she elevates the voices and experiences of female entrepreneurs building and running businesses in Africa. She's a professional conference moderator and actively serves on multiple boards, including 1952 Africa, where she's advocating for inclusive growth and the promotion of African art and culture. She's a qualified lawyer in the UK and Nigeria. She holds an LLB in law from the University of Kent and an LLM in commercial and corporate law from the University College London. In this episode, we'll dive into her journey from her early beginnings and the beliefs she's had to unlearn to her vision for Africa's business landscape and how she's using storytelling to inspire a new generation of leaders. So sit back, guys, and let's get into the conversation with the incredible Miss Akego. How you doing?
Oh, hi Mo. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I was just thinking, you get into, for shout out to Chulu, who was the connection between myself and Akego, by the way. I met Akego, I want to say, yeah, 5 years ago.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Around the pandemic. We had this African women podcaster support group that would meet, I think it was once a week. I don't remember how long.
It was once a week.
Once a week, just to, you know, catch up and see what are, you know, pain points and how do we support one another. And you meet people on this platform. What brought us together was podcasting. Mm-hmm. But then by the time you start seeing, oh my goodness, like, oh my God, she's so qualified. Oh my goodness, she's so smart. You're like, wow, you know. And even reading through your repertoire, I'm like, my goodness, like, do I even have the resume to talk to this person? But anyways, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And it's worth the wait. Guys, I have been chasing this woman down for the past 5 years to come on my podcast. I remember the last time I sent her, like, hey, you know, here's a form, fill it out. And she was like, you know, I need more time. I remember I was traveling out of the country. I was on the phone, like, my plane was about to take off and I had to quickly make that phone call. And I remember, okay, I'm going to have to wait because, like, a good cup of tea, this will be what, you know, the time whenever I just wait, just be patient. So I decided to try again one more time because we're running this entrepreneurial series, right? And she said yes. And I was like, ah! So I reached out to my team. I'm like, the person you're about to bring on the podcast, you guys need to come correct. So I want the questions to be very tight. Like, don't be asking her things that we can always go Google and get your answers to. So I hope it's going to be worth, you know, your time, the listeners, and of course, Akego's time. So let's start from the very beginning. Where are your roots and how would you say your upbringing has shaped your perspective on life in general?
Well, before I go into that, thank you again. And like you said, shout out to Chulu for making this, you know, connection for us, for creating community for us to meet. And no pressure at all. You put me under no pressure at all, Mo. Well, let's start from the very beginning. One of my most favorite all-time movies, Sound of Music. It's always a good place to start. So I'm from the eastern part of Nigeria, but I was born and raised in Lagos, which is in the West for people who don't know Nigeria. I'm the first of four children, and we had quite a fun and idyllic childhood. My father worked with the Airport Authority, so we lived in this estate, aviation kids, as we called ourselves. We didn't have any fences. We didn't have any gates. Everyone had a bicycle. There was a pool house and a tennis court. Extremely idyllic. It was a fantastic place to have grown up back in the day. You know, they say how those days when things worked in Nigeria.
Right.
So it was a lot of fun, you know, and that was something that was very key to my mom, you know, having fun. We have a joke with my siblings and I, Isim's last words, famous last words, enjoy yourselves, you know. So even though we were a very academically driven family, like most Nigerian households, you know, there was always a focus on fun and finding joy in whatever you did, you know. Both my parents studied economics. My mom went down the entrepreneurial path, but my dad was a transport economist. And like I said, he worked in the aviation space and he traveled a lot and took us on a lot of those trips. So I spent a lot of my childhood visiting a lot of African countries. And, you know, it sparked in me a curiosity, you know, about cultures outside of Nigeria. And today I fondly describe myself as a proud Nigerian and a passionate Pan-Africanist. And I think that foundation was laid in my childhood, and I'm grateful to my parents for that.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. And so the place you grew up, what part of Lagos was that? Ikeja?
In Ikeja, yeah, right. Oh, okay. Opposite the local airport, the
really?
old
really?
Yeah, just right there. It was called Strabag. Strabag had built it, and wow. It became the Airport Authority staff quarters. So right there, opposite the airport.
I think it's not too far from where Legend Hotel is right now, right? Do you know where Legend Hotel is? Where there's a mosque?
Yes, Legend.
Very close to the toll road, yeah.
Yeah, so Legend is further down after International Airport.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're on the other side.
Wow. Okay, thanks for sharing that. I didn't even know you were the first of your siblings and all that. Okay.
I am.
Okay, all right. So growing up, what values would you say were instilled in you by your family that have stayed with you throughout your career? So I can imagine that from your parents, you know, the sense of family and even your dad's work, you know, in aviation, and both of them being economists. I see how that has even shaped your career, because you've done a lot of work in aviation as well. But in addition to all those things, what values or principles would you say have shaped, you know, you and have stayed with you throughout your career?
Yeah, I think a strong sense of family. I think that was very, very important to both my parents individually and even, you know, coming together. And even today with my siblings, we're very, very close. And I think a lot of it was the intention with which my mom pursued creating memories and opportunities for us to be together, you know, and I continue to carry that forward. I think all my siblings would testify that, you know, I'm there day one. You need me, I'm there. And I think they're the same for me as well. And lucky to have married someone who has a strong sense of family as well. And so if anybody has to drop and be there for another member of the family, it's understood, it's expected. And I value that a lot. Another thing that we value as a family, especially from, it came a lot from my dad, was just excellence with purpose. You know, everything, you have to show up as your best self in every experience, in everything you do, you know, even down to how you look. I tell my children that how you dress is, you know, is 50% of the job done. You know, you show up, people see you and they receive you or they push you back just based on how you present, you know, how you do your work. And then, you know, with the purpose element was, you're here not just for yourself. There's a greater good. My parents spent a lot of time, like most of our parents, you know, investing in other people, paying for people's education, you know, the whole, when people are surprised about the remittances from here back to the continent, Africans are not surprised, because it's what we do as a
people. Exactly, we pay back,
you know? Yes, yeah, pay back, pay forward. Mm-hmm. So that was quite a big value that I try to live out, even in the things I do in the you know, I'm just constantly seeking impact, how to have impact in my community, in the communities that I encounter, and in whatever work that I do. The last thing I'll talk about is resilience. And I think that features a lot in my life, you know, and I think a lot of it has come from my parents and the experiences that we've been through as a family over the years, you know, just realizing that obstacles are part of the journey. It's not a reason to stop, but, you know, it's that whole glass half full, half empty, you know, kind of thing, and seeing every obstacle as an opportunity to push forward. I was recently studying the eagle and how, you know, it needs contrary winds to be able to move forward, and likening, you know, that strive, that resilience to mounting on those wings and riding those contrary winds. And I think a lot of that I saw demonstrated throughout my parents' lives, and I continue to just, you know, push forward.
Yeah. That was so beautifully shared. Thank you so much. Thank you. So a family with four kids. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have two sisters and one brother.
Okay. So is it you first and then the two girls?
I'm first, yes. Yeah. Then two girls. My brother is last, but he's like our father. So, you know.
Probably taller as well.
No, he's taller, but he's such a responsible individual. It's incredible. Truly blessed as a family by him. So, yeah. I mean, my sisters are amazing, I should say, because they will listen to this, so I should.
Well, shout out to Izim's kids, like you said, right?
Yes.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about your educational trajectory as well. So growing up in Lagos, how did you find your way to study law and all of the degrees you amassed along the way? Nigerian, they carry last, indeed.
No, they carry last. And if my father had survived, I probably would have done a PhD at the rate
he
was pushing. No joke. Oh, wow, that was his ultimate desire. So I am very, very. I think in Nigeria, you know, back in the day, there were only a couple of professions you could really do. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be a lawyer, a doctor, and
engineer, or nothing else.
Yeah. If that failed, then maybe you can be an accountant, but maybe, you know. But my parents never had any such expectations. They wanted you to do what you wanted to do. I think my dad secretly nursed me being a lawyer, but never really pushed me in that direction. Mm-hmm. I hated math. You know, and I couldn't stand blood. So in my mind, the only thing left for me to do was to be a lawyer. But this is a conversation for another day. It's a whole podcast on its own. I had a visceral fear of public speaking. So I wasn't sure how to become a lawyer and not have to speak publicly. And then I found out that in the UK, most of my friends were going to America at the time. And then I found out that in England, there were two separate tracks. You could be a barrister who goes to court, or you could be a solicitor who did transactions and desk work, and you don't have to speak in public. And I was like, this is what I want to do. You know? So I chose the path of least resistance, and it all came naturally to me. I mean, I'm giving to problem solving and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, yes, this is a nice way to give back and support people. And I decided I wanted to study law. So that's how I went to study law. And my father was like, well, you don't just stop at a degree, you should do a master's. And so I was like, okay, sir, you know, and went ahead to do that. But at some point, I decided I didn't want to practice. And that's, again, you know, that's a long story in itself. Yeah. But I did eventually come in that time. I lost my dad. Thank you so much. And because it was something he wanted so much for me, I embraced it as my own passion and then decided to go and qualify, which I'm very grateful that I did. And, you know, even though it sometimes it feels like you're pursuing another person's dream, but it became my dream, It became my passion I wanted to be an aviation lawyer. And I pursued that, studied law, moved back to Nigeria, qualified in Nigeria, a fantastic experience. I hadn't been in Nigeria since I was 16, so it was great to come back as an adult. And I did everything, including NYSC. And,
oh, wow. You know, he went all the way.
Sing Amala in the Buka. And, you know, that was fantastic, you know. So I went to serve at the Civil Aviation Authority. This was me going back into taking the aviation path, which was incredible. It was great to see things firsthand. I remember working on Nigeria, obtaining category one status is what you need for you to fly direct. Our ability to fly United from Lagos
to Houston,
To Houston or Lagos to DC, you know, happened. That whole process happened while I was a youth copper at the Civil Aviation Authority. So that was quite cool. And then I had an opportunity to, someone came, another aviation kid like me came and pitched an idea and said, let's go build a facility for private jets.
Wow.
And I'm like, what does that look like? You know, I went through the regs and I was like, there's nothing in here about business aviation or general aviation, you know, but I guess that's the joy of being young.
Yeah.
There were four of us. We set off to build this facility and that was, it was an amazing time. I was there for 6 years and then my family moved to the US and, you know, life took off in a different direction.
I mean, as you're just painting your career and just everything you've done, even hearing your voice, the joy of, you know, merging all the passions that you've amassed along the way and seeing it come into fruition, you know, your love for aviation, you know, with your childhood and all those exposure you had, and being able to think of the strides you've made, especially when you talked about the category one status we got for the first time in Nigeria, and then working together and, you know, building the very first private, you know, jet terminal and aircraft maintenance facility in Nigeria. And despite you, you know, being from, like, all the geographical footprints you had, the heart you had for Nigeria is still palpable in telling your story. So I just wanted to highlight that. And thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah. So you moved to the US. How long have you been here for?
August would be 10 years.
Wow.
Coming up on 10 years. Unbelievable.
Are you like me in the sense of, even though you're so far away from home, there's always just that heart for Nigeria. And you find yourself, even if it's just once a year, just wanting to go back and touch the grass there and, you know, be with the people and then maybe run back to the US. But there's always just that love for Nigeria, right?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I'm super grateful that I ended up in a career that allows me to do that. So both personally and professionally, I get to go home often. I get to you know, touch base with home regularly, and I'm very grateful for that because it will always be home. I miss it. I miss it quite a lot. Yeah,
right. There's no place like home down there, like they always say. So, when you came to the US, and I know that law has different, you know, there's different subspecialties and how you can consider one. I imagine that you just branching out into entrepreneurship maybe got more magnified when you moved to the US. So what has your career been like since you moved to the US, and how are you also keeping in touch with those other passions of your life, like aviation law and all that?
Yeah, I would describe my you know, they say the many are the plans in a man's heart.
Right.
And my career has been quite a jungle gym, but quite an interesting jungle gym. And sometimes you just yield to the process, you know. So when I came here, my kids were really young. They were 2 and 4 at the time. And I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. But I knew that I wanted to stay connected to the continent. That much I knew. I danced around the idea of qualifying and being a lawyer, and it didn't quite, just the time required, the kind of time requirement was challenging for me. My husband didn't move with us initially, so he's here now, which is fantastic. But in the beginning, because we actually thought it was a temporary move. I thought I was coming here for 2 to 3 years and I was going back, you know. So I started exploring other things and, you know, meeting people and going out to different networking events in DC. Networking is amazing. Hopefully I will get to speak more about that in our conversation.
Sure, yeah.
And I met this lady who was a lobbyist in DC, and just talking about my experience and where I was coming from and saying that I wanted to do more Pan-African. You know, yes, I knew Nigeria. I'd had a strong network in Nigeria, in the aviation space, in government, but I wanted to expand my experience. And she recommended this organization. She said, why don't you go and speak to, the idea was to go and speak to the then CEO, just to get a sense of what the Africa business landscape was like. That was the suggestion. So I scheduled a meeting, and on my way to the meeting, a friend of mine, Chinwe, calls, and she was like, oh, have you Googled this organization? I was like, no, not really. She's like, they have an opening. I don't know if this is what I want to do. She's like, well, just worth knowing. Yeah. I was on the metro. I'll never forget that conversation or where I was. So I get there. I have an amazing conversation with Steve Hayes, who was the then CEO. And on my way out, I said, oh, I noticed you have an opening. Can I interview for it? And he was
just like that.
And he was like, really? Are you interested? I said, yeah, you know, I would like to get some U.S. work experience. And he, you know, asked me to go and schedule an interview. So I went through the whole interview process and I got the job.
What?
Literally, yes, 6 months into moving to the U.S. I had no idea what this organization was. And I remember saying to my brother-in-law, an attorney, oh, I got the job. And he was like, no way, do you know what CCA is? And I was back in the day, they were the only game in town. Like, if you were doing business, if you're a U.S. company doing business in Africa and you were not part of the Corporate Council in Africa, then you hadn't started. So it was a big deal and I had no idea. But I just know that God opened that door for me. And so I went to work with CCA. Steve left 6 months after I joined.
Oh no.
I know. But then we got a new CEO who is a mentor to me today. Flory. Flory's amazing. She came in and, you know, we rode through some severe winds, you know, and we came out okay as an organization. Excuse me. We came out okay as an organization, but I learned so much more about the continent. My experience of Africa wasn't just traveling and, you know, and books I was reading. I was actually now engaged in what opportunity looked like, what business looked like, and how things were different in different parts of the continent. You know, I was there for 5 and a half. It was an amazing experience. It was an amazing learning experience. And, you know, sometimes I call it thankless work because it's nonprofit, because they're not there when you're cheering, but they open doors and they pave the way and they advocate for U.S. businesses, you know, and it was good work. It was good work. It was good exposure. And it was while I was there that the idea of African business story was conceived, to be honest. Yeah.
I mean, look at that, you know, from, you know, your friend just mentioning, oh, do you know what this business is about? And then you're just on the whim just saying, hey, you know, you have a position. Can I apply for it? And I imagine that if you had known just how big it was, you probably would have scared yourself out of applying.
Yes, I probably would have. I probably would have. Like, no, this is not for me.
But
I hadn't even researched it.
And I imagine that's not the kind of person you are. You always want to go into things like knowing everything about it.
Knowing everything.
Yeah. Isn't how amazing how God just put blind spots intentionally in our lives to kind of help us get where we need to get to, and then we realize, oh my goodness, did I just get this job? You know? Oh, wow. So CCA, right? Which, and even knowing a little bit about them, and that core partnership they tend to have between, like, in merging just two worlds, you know, US, the US and the African continent, like strengthening those commercial relationships. What would you say, you know, based on your experience working there, you said for about 5 years, right?
Yes.
What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions we hold or others hold about doing business on the continent?
I think, well, the main misconception, I don't even know if it's really a misconception, but it's probably exaggerated so much, is how corrupt, you know, Africa is doing business in Africa. You know, I think it's a misconception because there's corruption everywhere.
Everywhere, right? You know? And there's no special brand, you know.
There is no special brand, you know. It exists everywhere, and there are people who navigate and build in spite of, you know. And I think the higher the risk, the higher the reward. And I think Africa is one of such places. The main misconception, which is a personal pet peeve, is Africa is not a country.
You know,
the whole idea of, oh my God, you're from Africa. What language do you speak in Africa? And I'm like, Africa is 54 countries.
Yeah.
You know, Africa is 54 countries. And, you know, I used to grind my teeth through presentations where you have to first explain to people that Africa is 54 countries and show them a map and, you know, the different. So that for me is probably the biggest misconception. I mean, it's great that we today are able to talk about Africa as a single market the way we talk about Europe. But I think that in coming to invest, in coming to do business on the continent, you must be alive to the fact that it's 54 different countries, multiple languages, cultures, and business styles.
Yeah. Very heterogeneous. But one thing we can say, you know, just as someone who traverses both worlds, is we pride ourselves in building relationships. And once you can get into that, like, there's something just key about it. We can be as loyal as they can come, because relationships and building those connections really matter a lot more to us.
I agree.
Yeah. So now, this is an entrepreneurial series, so permit me to just spend a little bit of time just diving into this. How do you think African countries can better position themselves to attract foreign investments while ensuring inclusive growth for local communities?
African countries. So I'll start by saying, Lee, that I'm very proud of the direction African governments are taking today. That's where I'll start by saying that, yes, foreign investment is important, you know, but there's also a major push for regional trade, you know, on the continent. And I think that's the real game changer, because we're seeing the posture of the U.S., for example, towards, you know, the America First front. Yeah. And it's important that African countries too take an Africa First approach, you know, as well. And I think that that's where regional trade can be a game changer. Just statistically, I started by saying I'm not great in math, but I love data, you know, data doesn't lie. So, you know, at the moment, the trade between countries in Africa only stands at around something like 15%, whereas in Europe, you know, it's over 60%. You know, so being able to create a trading bloc where we can trade better with ourselves would help us, you know, as countries, you know, and one of the biggest moves that have been made recently is the creation of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area.
Yes, yes.
Which is the largest trading bloc in the world. The way you have Europe as a trading bloc, you know, the AFCFTA creates Africa as the biggest one. It's 1.4 billion people, you know, and it would increase if we are able to make it work, and I think we can, it will increase trade within the continent. There are some challenges. There are things that we still need to work on, but I feel like our leaders are alive to these challenges and are working towards fixing them. One of the big things is payments. You know, you want to buy something, you're in Lagos, you want to buy something in Kenya, you first have to buy dollar.
Which is very stressful.
And then you convert it to Kenyan shillings, value, and then you buy your stuff. So Afreximbank created this payment platform, Pan-African Payment and Settlement System, which allows you to trade between countries without converting to the euro or the dollar. So from a payments point of view, they've put the infrastructure in place to help us do better. You know, another big issue is how we move people, how we move goods, you know, logistics and transportation issues, you know, which exists, you know, your connectivity today. If you wanted to go from Lagos to Botswana on a private jet is 6 hours, but it will take you about 17 hours commercially because there's no direct flight. You fly to SA before you then get a different flight.
And it's expensive too.
And it's expensive, you know, moving goods is a challenge. You know, you have to move it by air freight, which is so expensive. So at the moment, they're working on something called the Lobito Corridor, which is a rail link that goes between Angola, Zambia and Tanzania, which allows us to move goods, you know, across the continent. So there are issues, there are challenges, but we can see that there's political will to fix some of these things, you know, and these kind of projects, you know, they make Africa, it's not just better for us, but it also improves the environment for investing, you know. And I personally believe, you know, that at the end of the day, no one is coming to save us.
We have to save ourselves,
Africa will be built by Africans, you know. And when we focus on putting the right infrastructure in place, strengthening our trade relations, you know, we can create opportunities that it doesn't just benefit, you know, foreign investors, but it also benefits those of us on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, that's what real inclusive growth is.
Yeah. I mean, you've said it so spot on. Thanks so much for highlighting that. And, I realized just how really difficult it is to move across Africa when it was last year during the FIFA Cup, and it was the finals was supposed to be played in Cote d'Ivoire. Mm. And my dad is a super football freak. I wanted to, you know, buy him a plane ticket to just go watch the finals. We hadn't even started talking about hotel and, you know, all of that. Let's just start with the flight. I looked at the ticket. Okay, go. Like, to fly to Cote d'Ivoire, which if you wanted to drive down, maybe like 15 hours because of the traffic and all that. We didn't want to risk that.
Hmm.
But it was 53 hours. They were going to take you to France and get there and stay there for like a 12, 13 hour layover and then bring him all the way back down to Cote d'Ivoire. And I'm like, it's just next door. Mm-hmm. You know? And then the price of it was almost like $3,000, which, if I'm flying from US to Lagos, you know, from Oklahoma in the middle of nowhere, I don't spend that much on plane tickets. So I was like, my goodness, this is crazy. We're still within the same West Africa block. But yeah, thanks for highlighting just some of the challenges we have.
Yeah.
But I'm also more encouraged about the innovations and the solutions we are providing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that is Afrocentric, right?
It too.
We know that Africa is incredibly diverse, right? And there's so many transformations happening, like you highlighted with the African Continental Free Trade Area. Which countries do you think is making the most impactful strides, and especially strides that will create those ripple effects across the continent?
Oh my God, don't put me on the spot.
You will know this answer, I'm sure.
No, I don't think that there's an answer.
You know, really?
People's, yeah, opinions differ, you know, varied opinion. And it really depends on what you're looking for, you know. We sometimes, because we're Nigerian, we don't understand how much success Nigeria has achieved until you go to another African country and then you realize that, oh my God, you know, Nigeria is actually way ahead. You know, we stay here and the grass is always green on the other side,
right? You get this, Nigeria.
Exactly. You know, even things like local content, Nigeria is a pioneer when it comes to ensuring local content. You know, I've been to a lot of African countries where there's no local participation in their oil and gas value chain. None. Mm. It's all run by foreigners. Mm. You know, that would never happen in Nigeria. You know, that would never happen in Nigeria. We have solidified, you know, and institutionalized local content. So we own industry. If you're a foreign company coming to operate in Nigeria, majority stake must be held by Nigerians. Great. And a lot of countries around Africa haven't come to that point yet. You know, I remember a lady I interviewed in season one of my podcast, Monica Masunda. She owns a noodle company in Zambia. And in Zambia, most of the businesses are run by foreigners. You know? And she came to work for Dangote in Nigeria, and she'd never seen a black person with such power and authority where Caucasians were working for him. You know, and it caused her to have a mind shift.
Wow.
And so she started thinking, she was a lawyer, but she started thinking, I want to go home and I want to build a business in Zambia. And she spent a lot of time brainstorming what to do. And then eventually, you know, noodle business was controlled by India, and she broke into that market and dominated it.
Wow.
So kudos to countries like Nigeria, not because I'm Nigerian, but because I've traveled widely on the continent. And I know that they're leading. Are there things that need to be fixed?
Of course,
and,
of course.
You know, But in terms of local content and pushing the indigenous people to own, operate, and participate in global value chains, I think that Nigeria is, you know, quite ahead. Same with South Africa, I would say. But there are smaller countries where they're very nimble because of how small they are. Countries like Botswana, you know, they're very nimble. They have maybe safer than some other countries. So they are making strides in different ways. And in Botswana, for example, education and healthcare is free. The money they make from their diamonds, they use it to educate their population and give them health care. And I think that is incredible. You know, there's a lot to be learned from countries like Botswana when it comes to how you use the wealth of your natural resources to empower your people.
Your people, yeah.
I could talk about different countries in different ways, but, you know, I think I made my point.
Oh, thanks. And even though you said there was no answer to that question, I think you've answered it all. But I mean, there's something you said that I just want to highlight as well. I remember going to Nigeria shortly before COVID, so maybe 2019 thereabout, and I had a GTB account, and I wanted to pay, and they told me about, oh, you can just send money to somebody in another bank, and I'm like, no, person doesn't have a GTB account. Like, just put in the account number, it's gonna populate the name.
Mobile money, yes.
That just blew. I was like, you guys have that? Like, you can just. Like, I have Bank of America here, right? And I also have Chase. If I'm sending money to, before we had Zelle, you can't even do that. You're going to accrue,
Don't compare America. When it comes to mobile money, that's the whole leapfrogging we talk about in Africa. You know, the mobile technology helped us leapfrog in ways that, you know, Kenya is the leader
fintech and all that. Yeah. But look at even POS, the way it just blew up. America just feels like it's still in the, you know, dark ages with the way, you know, money just, if not for Zelle. There's no way you can communicate with other banks. And we've done this so well and so seamless. And so to your point about just the innovations that are happening, I just wanted to highlight that. And even Rwanda, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on their startup hub you know, strong governance. I think they're touting it now to be like the next Singapore of Africa. Let's see how that goes. But I mean, thanks for just making me, I mean, I'm proudly African, yes. But as we were just talking, my head was just swirling like, what? Yes, this is it. So you want to talk a little bit about networking and even looking at your repertoire. I mean, you've been in a lot of rooms at Kegel. Like, it's almost like, when you talk about 6 degrees of separation, I think for you, it's like 1 degree of separation. So tell us about the powerful, the importance of networking and how you go about cultivating that, given that you're also someone, it seems like you like to work behind the scenes.
Yes, very show much, us very your way. Much so. Very much so, you know. The goal is that things happen, not so much that, you know, you don't have to be seen all the time as long as things get
done. Don't loud it.
even though we come from a country where it's got to be loud, isn't it? I think networking is one of those things that we take for granted, or we don't understand the power of. And I think when I was young, I probably didn't understand the mm-hmm. power of networking, you know, but it's very important that we intentionally build circles around us, or that we take advantage of spaces that we find ourselves in. And sometimes I'm not saying that I don't know how to put this. It's not that we go out to meet people because of what we can get from them.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think there has to be a genuine interest to get to know people and to build relationships, and even just the one of the things that I used to do when I meet people is, you know, you take note of one. This is a very simple thing. You know, I always try to somehow find out when their birthday was, and you send a note. You know, you may never. Those notes that you get, Nigerians, I can't speak. I'm sure other people are good at this, but Nigerians are very good at staying in touch. They're very good, especially with their professional network. Whether it is sending people notes on their birthdays, you know, the hampers you send people at Christmas, you know, acknowledging, going to their events. All this is part of building your network. All this mm-hmm. is your social capital. And I think over the years, I've done my best to try and stay in touch with people. Without an ask, just really just staying in touch, because you never know when these relationships might be for a purpose or for a reason, for your benefit or for someone else's benefit. I owe my entire career to relationships, and every step I've taken in my career, whether it's been successful or has been or hasn't been, has been because of the network that I've created and the spaces that I've been able to leverage, if you know what I mean. I think that it's important that we try to cultivate relationships, you know, with people in the spaces where we work and in other spaces as well. You know, I'm part of my high school alumni group. You know, it's not a professional network, but it's a social network.
Yeah.
You know, so you build professional networks and you build social networks. And I know the type of support that I received when I lost my mom. It was incredible, you know, from my social networks and also from some professional networks. That was incredible. And I welcome every opportunity to show the same support to those sisterhoods. I'm in a book club, you know. You can tell that I like community, you know. We have our podcast group, you know, and then I'm in this book club. It's been incredible. So I encourage people to, sometimes it takes stepping out of your comfort zone. Yeah. You know, I say this and some people roll their eyes, but people that know me know, you know, I'm an introverted extrovert. So I'm very happy to be by myself.
Performative introvert, extrovert.
You know, very happy, but, you know, I strategically, I'm extroverted strategically. But I think that it's important to build community. And from community can come a lot of blessings and a lot of success. Yeah.
Thanks for that response. And even coming from you, I think there's a lot we can tease from there, especially as women who might not be as extrovertish as you expect Nigerian women to be. But how do you even get the most out of just those relationships? And it's by giving back and being intentional. And not with an agenda in mind, like, oh, I'm going to cash out something, but really, really cultivating that relationship. A simple note, a hello, or a happy birthday, or just something. And I love how you emphasize maintaining that over the years and how that has really helped you. I think there was something you said about your career. You couldn't have done it. You're not a self-made person.
No.
You know, acknowledge the importance of the communities you've built and the ones you've sustained and the intentionality behind those relationships. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk about African business stories. So you talked about how your career and being able to travel around and your time at the CCA and how that really helped you develop that. Oh my gosh, there's a story here to be shared. So maybe tell us a little bit about the driving force behind it and what impact you hope it will have on the African business landscape, as it were.
Sure. So I said before that, you know, I'm a lawyer. So at my core, I'm a problem solver, and African Business Stories really started as a passion project.
Oh.
You know, something I felt needed to exist. You know, I was at CCA, like I said, and we were hosting all these high level engagements with heads of state and senior business leaders. And, you know, we convene all these panels and plenaries, but there were hardly any women in the room.
Huh.
You know, and I'm like, where are the women? You know, I was coming from Nigeria, you know, fresh off the boat. And I'm coming from a country where women are moving things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that there's any country, any other country in Africa where at one point all the banks were chaired by women or have female group managing directors. We've done a lot on the in Nigeria as far as the corporate world is concerned. So I was coming from an environment where I saw women building businesses and running enterprise. And so to gather at these spaces and not see women bothered me a lot. And just in reading about women in Africa and stuff, I came across this World Bank data that said that there were more female entrepreneurs in Africa than any other region in the world.
And wow.
So, you know, I kept talking about it. And my brother was like, so what are you going to do about it? Like, you know, you're just like a broken record right now. And I was like, what if I found these women and I told their stories?
Yeah.
And I kept thinking about it, you know, it just really got under my skin. And I was like, okay, you know, being the type of African that we are, I'm like, what medium am I going to use? I used to listen to Guy Raz a lot, How I Built This. That's my best, like, he's my podcasting mentor. I was like, what if I did a podcast that was like Guy Raz's podcast, but focused on women? And a business podcast, you know, but I wanted to get a sense of them as well as tell their business story. And then I was like, but I don't know how to do this podcasting thing. And then they started On Deck, shout out to On Deck, cohort one of their podcasting fellowship. So I decided to go and do a fellowship on podcasting because that's in Nigeria and that's what you do.
Because why not?
Why not? You know, so I went. It was amazing. It was the best thing that I could have done for myself in terms of even just my confidence, even just knowing what to go, how to, just the strategy around podcasting. So I did that. I already, and, you know, I started off and I was already niched down very, very, very quickly. You know, so the first few classes wasn't really for me because I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I just didn't know how. So I finished that and launched my podcast focused on women, on finding these women and telling their stories. But it's evolved. It's evolved from that over the years, you know, listening to, I'd taken a break. I went into a different role and it was so busy and hectic. I had to pause my podcast when I was at DLA Piper. I had to pause my podcast. But it was still itching, you know, I still wanted to do this thing. So I went back and listened to all the episodes I'd done up to that point. And there was another issue. you know, money, access to finance. And I was like, we have to do more. I want to keep telling these stories, but we need to do more. Mm-hmm. And the more is, how do we help these women grow and scale their businesses? Mm-hmm. And so we launched the ABS Roundtable Series, which is a platform that brings women together with financiers, industry leaders, and opportunities to help them grow and scale their businesses, you know. And at the very heart of it, more is from what I hope, you know, is that ABS becomes more than just a platform, you know, that it actually becomes a bridge. Mm. A bridge to funding, a bridge to networks. You know, I can't tell you the amount of people who've connected and collaborated from interacting with our brand to opportunities, you know, that help African women to build these businesses and take them to the next level, you know, because I feel like visibility is powerful. You know, women are used to putting their head down, building and working, but we live in a time where you got to be seen and you got to be heard, you know, to even raise that money. The first thing you do when you apply for funding is that people Google you.
Yeah.
You know, and then your voice isn't out there. And so being able to give these women an opportunity for visibility, you know, I think is impactful. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And so how is it since 2020? How long has it been running for now?
Yes, since 2020. I think I did my coming soon announcement on, I will never forget, February 23rd. You know, so it's almost 5 years I did my coming soon announcement. And then, you know, my mom died in between. So, yeah, there was a pause. But it was part of my healing. Doing the podcast was part of my own personal healing journey. But yeah, it's been 5 years. Yeah.
Okay. So you've been hosting this podcast for a while, right? And you've talked about some of the challenges, like, you know, the fun and also the time. And I especially love how you said, okay, I didn't know a lot about this. So you got into a fellowship on deck. So shout out to them. So now for young African women, given just how we are, I think, born entrepreneurs, whether we decide to venture into that or not, we get things done, right? Mm. And proudly African, we have that space to really... We've always historically amplified the voices of women in our communities and the roles they play in, you know, passing down oral traditions and just keeping the family together. So kudos to us on that. Yeah. Now, for young African women who are aspiring to become entrepreneurs but may feel limited by societal or systemic barriers, what words of advice would you like to recycle to them?
Oh, gosh. You know, we're all so different. You know, I'm a Gen X, you know, Gen X. And I don't know what kind of advice you give to Gen Z girls, women, sorry, pardon me, what you give to Gen Z women, because, you know, as a Gen X, my advice is don't leave your day job, you know, build on the side. But that's not we're risk averse. Gen Zs are embracing risk with every single part of their being, you know, so advice to them is a little different, you know. I think my advice would be start where you are, which I believe that they do already. You know, they're not even aiming for perfection, which is a beautiful thing, you know. They have a freer spirit. So I would say to them, back to that, build your network. It's a lot is happening virtually and online, but I think that young women who are building businesses should be intentional about building their network, about being in spaces where they're not necessarily comfortable. You know, it's make out one thing that I did earlier on in building African business stories and building my voice was being intentional about picking how many conferences I wanted to attend and how many conferences I wanted to speak at, and having an accountability partner on that. Mm. You know, so I had partnered with a particular conference and moderated a lot at their conference, you know, and then attended certain conferences just to get to know people. And it's different in different spaces. In the US, the US Africa communities, it's a very small known community, and you work hard to build relevance and notoriety in that space. So your space could be energy, you know. So are you going to Africa Oil Week or Africa Energy Week every year? Are you going to intentionally set your mind to do that so you build in that space? You know, if you're in the VC space, do you go to Super Return? Do you go to Africa? Like, there's certain spaces where people who do what you do exist, and you need to get in those spaces, you know, and start to build your voice and to be persistent. You know, nothing comes easy. Nothing good comes easy. You hear many no's before you hear yes. Some people are lucky. They hear yes one time, but it's not and always it's easy, the case.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not always the case. So I would say keep building, be persistent, and be intentional about building your network and putting yourself in spaces where, you know, you can grow your network and grow your voice. Yeah.
Come full circle back to community and intentionality and persistence, right? Yeah. And those are the words you've lived by and evident by just the great works you've been able to do with your life and through the stories you share on your podcast and your life mission as well. So thanks a lot, Okego. I'm itchy to ask you about 1952 Africa because I know there's a big story there, but maybe I should save that for another time. It came up in your bio and I haven't followed your work for a while. Well, I think that's amazing, by the way. We haven't talked about it. Maybe we can save that for next time.
I can talk about it real quick.
Yes. So, okay.
Yeah, just very briefly. It's a segue. But 1952 is a foundation that was set up in honor of my mom. My mom was born July 1st, 1952. Oh. So it was set up in her honor, and she was a lover of people. And so... we were thinking about how to honor her and how to add value in a space that, in the art scene, it's really focused on art, you know, and art partly because it's something that, you know, we as a family are passionate about, but it's something that she personally invested in. Mm. So she invested in young artists, you know, in her own personal capacity and, you know, in buying their work, providing them tools. She ran a fashion house for a long time. So she was a creative as well and valued the creative space. And so this was set up in her honor. And the goal was to bring in young artists, give them a space to refine their skills and help them to improve their earning capacity. Mm-hmm. It's grown into my brother is the one who drives that ship tremendously. So all kudos to him. But it's grown into I think this year was the third or fourth cohort, and it was expanded to West Africa. So now we had it's a full residence, 6 to 8 weeks, where the artists come to Lagos and they're in a house, they get training and they produce a body of work that is sold, you know. I remember one artist, I think when he first came to the fellowship, maybe he was selling work for like $500. You know, his work is north of 5K, 10K today.
Wow.
I think the last piece of work when I was in Nigeria, I think he sold a piece for 4 million naira.
What?
You know, so I'm just saying that the ability to because this is a God-given talent, and the ability to provide a little guidance that allows them increase their earning capacity.
That's great.
You know, because the value of our art is not appreciated abroad, and it's part of our goal to make sure that it is, you know, that this God-given talent that people have, they can turn it into income and wealth for themselves and their families. So it's growing. They have a full team now that run 1952. We just show up and, you know, help spread the word now. So it's fully functioning. There's a program manager. They're doing all kinds of events. So we're, you know, I'm a little hands off from it, but it's work that ties into everything we are as a family, bringing impact, helping elevate other people, promoting the African culture. Our goal is that this residency program will be a Pan-African program, yeah. You know, and that we will see our artists in shows across the world, and that yeah. and that African art will command the value that it deserves, you know, on the global stage.
I think it's going to be a matter of time with the proliferation of social media and just being able to have that global stage now at the stroke of a keyboard. It's just a matter of time. And kudos to you, your team, and what you guys do at 1952 Africa to keep amplifying the voices of talented, passionate young Africans.
Thank you.
All right, rapid fire questions, two of them. What's your favorite African, as we round off, what's your favorite African proverb saying, and how does it guide your work?
My favorite, I have an absolute favorite. I don't even have to think. People who know me, you know, I say it all the time. You know, it's really, when you wake up is your morning. So ooh. It's an Igbo proverb.
Yeah.
And I'll say it in Igbo. Okay. And I'll repeat it again in English. So okay. It says, "Mbonye jitete bo ututu ya," which means when a person wakes up is their morning. Basically saying, don't compare yourself to anyone. Stay in your lane. When things start for you is when you're ready. You know, so that's my life's mantra. If it doesn't happen for me, it wasn't for me, it wasn't the time, you know. So I say to people, when you wake up is your morning, you know. So yeah, that really guides how I, if I didn't get my training contract, I got my training contract when I was meant to get my training contract.
Right.
I got that job when I was meant, you know, it happens for you, you know, times and seasons differ for all of us.
Thank you. And don't compare your money to somebody else's money.
No.
You know, you don't know how long it had to be asleep or awake for. So
that's
don't
right.
do that.
That's right.
Thank you. Okay, the last one. What's one piece of advice you wish you had received earlier in your career?
I think it goes back to the networking piece.
Yeah,
you know? You know, where now I, you know, I'm trying to drill it down into my children that your network is your net worth.
Mm.
I know it now, like it's you know, second nature. But sometimes, you know, I wish that when I was younger, when I was in England starting my career, that I knew it and I took full advantage of it in building and maintaining. You know, but like they say, oh, like I like to say, when you wake up is your morning.
It's your morning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great. This has been a wonderful time with you. I don't know how we're able to fit everything we talked about in an hour. But your story is a powerful reminder that entrepreneurship is more than just building businesses. It's about creating impacts, amplifying voices, shaping the futures. You never know just what you're doing right now, how that fits into the greater picture, but still keep going, especially when you're doing to the forest for the trees. And then through what you do at through African business stories, I strongly believe that it's not just you telling the narratives of female entrepreneurs, but even inspiring a new wave of leadership and innovation across the continent. The passion that even fought that, like seeing everything you saw around your travels and wanting to do something to keep amplifying those voices, I think that's something I would like for us to leave with listeners. And then your journey from legal and corporate leadership to driving investment into Africa and then elevating women's, you know, entrepreneurial success. That for me highlights the importance of strategic vision and the courage to challenge norms, especially from someone who you call yourself like an extroverted introvert, like someone that can like switch in between. But there's a power that comes to knowing, having that self-awareness and knowing that despite that, I can still do great things. So I wanted to, I mean, keep emphasizing that, especially for people who might fall in, you know, same personality range. And so I hope that to our listeners, the Akego story has left you with valuable takeaways and renewed inspiration. And to just keep pushing the envelope. And do not forget the importance of networking. You can't just do it alone. No man is an island, right? And even Africans, we always say it takes a village. So find your people, build those connections, sustain those connections, and find a way to pay forward. You know, through stories like Akego is doing, or through their ventures at 1952 Africa. Whatever you do, do not live in isolation. Do not do life alone. So we hope that this episode really has a lot for you to pick a lot of gems from. And because, again, and just go out there and just go do great things. And because the future really belongs to those who dare to create it. So until next time, everyone, keep dreaming, keep building, and keep telling your story. And thank you so much, Akego. It was such an honor. Honor to have you on the podcast finally.
Thank you so much, Mo. This has been an amazing conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I have a feeling we'll bring you back, but I won't scare you off just yet. But I'll keep in touch and have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Bye.